You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Liberty has always carried tricky questions with it. Most folks in 2025 would agree that human beings should have liberty, but how one becomes free persists as a debate. Do we spring fully free into this world? Does participation in certain kinds of political communities and other communities make us free? Can education of this or that sort develop freedom? This last question leads a conversation into the possibility of liberal arts, and Richard Detweiler's book, The Evidence Liberal Arts Needs, takes up not only a discussion of what makes an education a liberal arts education, but also why and how people in our moment should still make the case for liberal arts. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome Dr. Detweiler to the show. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be with you, Nathan. Thank you for the invitation.
This book's persistent project is to broaden the ways in which academics study liberal arts, shifting the focus from the kinds of courses taught to what I see as three constellations of questions: purpose and content and context. What do we gain when we broaden our scope and study this broader collection of concerns rather than focusing on how many philosophy or art history courses a given student completes?
Well, it is certainly a sign of our times that the focus that is persistent is really on what are the courses you're going to take? What are you going to learn in those courses? What's interesting, not only based on my research, but broader research as well, is that merely studying something does not create any necessary life outcomes, let alone learning outcomes. So if you really care about impact, that is, what are you creating through an educational experience, or from a student's perspective, what am I going to learn in this educational experience that will have long-term value to me? Then you need to look at what college is about far more broadly than just which courses am I going to take. So, you know, why am I going to go to college? Is it to get a better income? Sure, that's fine to have a good job, but does one want to be happy? Does one want to live a more fulfilled life? And I think it's engagement in those kinds of questions that really change the nature of what you should think about when you're thinking about what a higher education is, or in general, or what a liberal arts education is in particular.
That's interesting. I mean, when I was a professor, I served at a Christian liberal arts college whose mission was still expressly confessional. So, I mean, when you turn your exam in towards common good as one of the purposes for liberal arts, that resonated with, you know, my own sense of what I was doing when I was a professor. So here's a question that occurs to me. Would liberal arts colleges do better to continue to appeal to investment? You're making an investment in your future, this and that. Or, I mean, would we, and I say we, I've been out of the academic world for a couple of years now, would liberal arts institutions do better to present themselves more adversarially and contend against consumeristic ideals of education in favor of something more like service?
I mean, it's probably the most vexing issue facing many colleges and universities today, and that is, what is it they are offering to students and to their parents and to the society and the legislatures and everybody else? So it's an issue of great contention, and the answers tend to be, or the questions and answers tend to be adversarial, and focus on immediate short-term impact. How much are you going to earn when you graduate? And those kinds of questions. And students get caught up in that same thing as well. So when they're thinking about college, they're not, generally speaking, thinking about it in any deep or complex kind of ways. But younger people today do oftentimes have an interest in bettering humanity, bettering society. They want a good job and all of those kinds of things, but they also want to live a life that is meaningful and not empty. And so that then leads to the question, what can colleges do to really connect into those deeper motivations young people generally have? And that's hard because you need to move the conversation beyond the 3-minute quick look at a couple stats and ideally engage the young person, potentially college bound person, in thinking more seriously about why they want to go to college and what they want to get out of their own future. And that's something much more likely to occur with if parents did that, if teachers did that, if guidance counselors mm-hmm. did that, if friends did that, rather than focusing on the short term. So I would say colleges need to be confident, not defensive. And today they are too often defensive, confident about saying, here's what we stand for, and think in somewhat greater depth about what matters to you in your life, or for a parent, what matters to you for your child's life. I mean, I have had countless conversations with parents, and yes, they, you know, the horror story is the college graduate who's come back home and is now living in the basement or whatever. You know, that's a horror story, not because it's really a horror, because most parents indeed do love their kids and do want them to be to live a reasonable life, but they want them to live a happy and fulfilled life more than anything else, and so figuring out how to make those connections, I think, is the big challenge colleges face. So they should face that with confidence, not with defensiveness.
Sounds good. That sounds good. Well, one interesting trend that I saw early in the book is that you use phrases like student-centered learning and engaging pedagogy. And it occurred to me that some of our listeners are going to think that these are kind of holdovers from the 1960s, but you make the case that liberal learning has always involved concerns with how students learn as much as why they learn. So what has changed most substantially in the last 60 years when it comes to pedagogy? And, you know, what inquiries into teaching and learning have older pedigrees?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the last 60 years or whatever, there have been quite a number of changes in our society and facing American higher education. Certainly efforts to broaden the participation in higher education has increased. So there's a far broader range of people engaged in higher education that in an earlier age never would have considered a higher education. So the older population of years earlier was a far more homogeneous, people who were well prepared, who knew how to study, who, if they had issues, had resolved them sufficiently to be able to be successful in college, et cetera. Today's students have far more complicated needs, mental health issues, health issues, learning issues. So that is far more complicated to deal with, partly at our own initiative. Services on colleges have become far more specialized. You know, in 1955, if you were on a team, you know, a basketball team, it's likely that your coach would be a professor. That's mm-hmm. the way, or the advisor to your club was always going to be a professor who was there. You know, you could go to the professor's house because they live near campus and eat dinner with their family. All those kinds of things used to happen. Now there's specialization. So there's academic affairs and there's student life. And those are greatly separated and far more specialized. And there are now mental health specialists and health specialists and all the kinds of things like that. Consumerism has also increased. So there is an expectation of better facilities, athletics facilities, workout places, and all of those kinds mm-hmm. of things. So all of those changes have made higher education more complex than it used to before, and has created a contrast then between the content of study, which is the domain of the professor and academic affairs, and all of the rest of a college experience. And that then has also, at the same time, demean the notion of engagement or involvement. So student-centered learning is now defined in very narrow terms, like, do you have discussion in class?
Right.
And not much more than that. And so it's not really a 1960s ideal. It's really a 3,000-year-old ideal that that needs to characterize the full nature of the educational experience, not just something that a professor does in their specific class.
That makes some good sense. One of the interesting metaphors that, again, you work with pretty persistently through the book is the metaphor span, in both the sense of breadth and in the sense of bridging. And it seems like span for you is more important, like we mentioned before, than the particular classes that show up on the transcript. So what does your concern with curriculum share with movements for interdisciplinary learning? And what distinctions would you draw between a wide spanning learning and interdisciplinary learning?
Yes, they are certainly partners, and there is a great deal of overlap. Where I would say there is not overlap is that interdisciplinary studies typically focus on making a course interdisciplinary. So you have two professors from two different disciplines teach a course, or you design a course and a student needs to take one, two, or three of them that are deliberately, you know, bio psychology or whatever, right, as opposed to being a narrower topic. When I use span, I'm including that, but I'm also using it far more broadly to say students need to study outside of specialized or their own major area and take courses in a lot of different disciplines as one important dimension of their learning experience. And second is, professors in all classes should be bringing ideas from outside their own discipline into their course content. So if I'm teaching a psychology course, I need to include a consideration of ethics, for example, in what it is that I'm teaching, or the implications for society for what it is I'm teaching. And that can be applied in physics as well as psychology, or in history or sociology or any disciplinary area. So students need to have their thinking become spanning, to have their thinking span across singular disciplinary areas. So study in lots of different courses very deliberately, and having every course link itself to areas outside its the own disciplinary specialization.
So when it comes to that bridging feature, I mean, that's one of the things that I liked the most when I read this. Do you imagine formal faculty training to encourage this? Do you imagine a change in the way we do grad school? All of the above? None of the above? Am I missing your point entirely?
No, all of the above and all of the above and more. You know, what the feature of graduate education is increasing narrowness and specialization. The stature of a professor has to do with their ability to increasingly please, that is, by what they speak about and write about, people who are as narrow or narrower than they are in the perspectives they bring. When it comes to that teaching and learning environment, what we need is for graduate education to include some of these same kinds of ideas. Well, there are implications for our area for other aspects of human life. It needs to involve the orientation or, in fact, in interviews of faculty who are being considered for faculty positions, and engage them in thinking about how they might have the courses they will teach bring in some broader perspectives. It has to do with workshops for faculty to learn how to do that well. When I was a faculty member, I was expected to be involved in improving student writing. So I needed to do, I didn't know anything about that. I knew how to write my disciplinary stuff, which was, of course, the more illegible it was to the standard human, the better it was. But to learn how to encourage students to write well. So I needed to do a faculty workshop on that. It has to do with faculty evaluation. What are the criteria upon which faculty are promoted or tenured or compensated? So it's doing all of those things so that ultimately the faculty member becomes an example to students about learning, thinking, more broadly. So that's all related to this notion of span and how we might do it better.
Very good. The evidence part of your book's title is going to go into a very deep statistical study and it's going to concern the second half of the book. But before you get there, you offer an overview of the liberal arts that is narrative in character, rather than starting with a, you know, an abstract definition of liberal arts. So what advantages come from starting with the story of liberal arts rather than, you know, liberal arts, noun phrase, and then, you know, an abstraction?
Yes. Well, I have to say that that approach came to me a bit late. That is, I've had my entire professional career of 40 plus years in higher education, and I have read countless books and articles and heard speeches about and advocacy about the liberal arts and what it is. And as I look through those systematically, as I matured in my career and I was a college president, and I was needing to speak about what I was doing all the time, both the, you know, campus visitation days to prospective parents and students, as well as to professional colleagues at conferences. And there were so many different kinds of answers given. Ultimately, we confused everybody we spoke with or were trying to persuade what we were doing made sense, as well as I ended up concluding ourselves. Literally hundreds of different definitions. I did a systematic review of what the liberal arts is, what higher education is about, and literally hundreds of different definitions. So at that point I said, you know, what is it that I have committed my life to? I've been doing my best to persuade everybody it's worthwhile and makes sense, but I can come up with my own definition that I'm happy with, but others will say, oh, that's nice, but what about this? What about that? So that's the point at which it occurred to me, gee, I wonder where this thing that we are doing came from. I mean, I know about the, you know, ancient Greeks and Romans, and I had read some of those things and things that had to be in the liberal arts. But then I knew there was a big gap between that time and what it is we're doing now. So that led me to begin reading the history rather than the description of what the philosophy of a particular or what the thinking of a particular philosopher was, et cetera, to say, you know, there's a story here. What is the story of this kind of educational experience? And so I jumped back in time, you know, 2,500, nearly 3,000 years to begin looking at literally what were the practices, what was being done. Mm-hmm. So what was being done and what, so how, you know, the how it was being done, what people were studying, you know, and in its earliest days, the beginning of liberal arts education, in fact, was the training of warriors, which makes mm-hmm. some humanists today uncomfortable, but that's a fact. That's not been true through all the 3,000 years, but that made sense given its purpose at that time. But as societies evolved and developed, then the whys, the purposes began to evolve and change to be more recognizable mm-hmm. to us today. And so I just began to trace that then through its development in Greece and then in Rome and then in the Middle East and then finally back into Europe and here to North America. And there was just for me, a fascinating story of a approach to education that developed and evolved and was in fact perfected over literally millennia in ways in which the content changed, what was being studied changed, but how it was being done was always in a very engaging kind of way. And its purpose was always to serve a broader need. Yes, the individual, but to help benefit society as well. So that let me ignore, in fact, all of the advocacy and the complex philosophical arguments to just say, you know, what is it? Let's look at this in a far more practical way. What is this? Why is it being done? How is it being mm-hmm. done? And that led to different kinds of insights than have been typical.
Now, I do want to take issue with one element of your historical chapter, both for myself and also for our listeners who pick up your book, which they should. You do well to highlight the importance of medieval Baghdad in the story of learning and teaching, but you also present Pope Sylvester II as someone who almost brings learning into a blank slate version of Europe, introducing learning where nobody had done anything like it for centuries. So my question is, do figures like Augustine of Hippo, Boethius, Alcuin, Charlemagne, Alfred, you know, the anonymous authors of, you know, Old English texts and medieval French texts on education. What place do those texts have, and what place do those institutions have in your story of European liberal arts?
Yes, you are right. I did not mention one of the individuals or great works that you just mentioned. So how could I have been so misguided as to have done that? And really, there are two parts to the answer. Part one is that I worked very hard to stay clear of philosophical or theological or history of thought content, mm-hmm. because to me it is important, but it was not the story I was trying to tell. The story I was trying to tell was really a history of education told non-conventionally. It's not the one mm-hmm. people typically read about. So have all of those individuals or works contributed to the content of education as we understand it in important ways today? Absolutely, yes. So what was important about Pope Sylvester? And you're right, I mean, Europe was not a blank slate upon which Pope Sylvester wrote. There was a great deal still happening in Europe during that time. But what had been lost during that time was both a thinking about the nature of advanced education, mm-hmm. and a deliberate reach out into broader areas of knowledge, so the span of knowledge kind of idea. And what mm-hmm. Sylvester contributed, I'm sure he contributed things theological as well. I don't know that. But what I do know...
He was Pope, after all.
He was Pope, that's right. A very controversial one, because some of his ideas were heresy, in fact, at the time. So, but what he did is he, in some sense, role modeled the idea that, hey, we can reach to other places outside of our own area, domains of knowledge, to learn things. So by bringing mm-hmm. back ideas about mathematics or, you know, astronomy or mm-hmm. medicine, which he happened to bring back from the Islamic Golden Age back into Europe, what he was doing was saying education now needs to be inclusive of these far broader areas of human mm-hmm. knowledge. And that then contributed very directly into the reemergence of a liberal arts approach to education in Europe, one that had been lost for a period of time after the fall.
All right. Well, let's turn to the modern era, and we'll let our listeners engage in, you know, some of the connecting steps. But in the modern era, your story pits the liberal learning model of early modern Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard and Yale against the meteoric rise of the German-style university, defined by, as we said before, specialization and research publication rather than inquiry and community. So one of the interesting predicates that you assign to those German universities is monarchical. I've heard a lot of critiques of the German university. That's the first time I've heard that one. What mm-hmm. about German universities is monarchical?
Well, right. And I want to be careful not to characterize every German university today as monarchical, because of course the monarchy is gone.
Right.
But what happened in Germany, Prussia, in fact, at that time was, this was immediately post-Napoleon, and the economy and many of the national structures of nations in Europe had been destroyed, including the majority of the universities. I mm-hmm. frankly don't know why this happened or how this happened, but a majority of universities were actually destroyed by Napoleon or his troops and followers. And so the King of Prussia at that time needed, as when Napoleon fell, then he needed to do something to kickstart his nation. And so what he did, based on advice mistaken in many ways, mistakenly by Humboldt, who is himself a great educational thinker, just a few of his ideas were incompletely implemented, but they were implemented with great alacrity. was to create that the university needed to be a research place that directly contributed to the economic and political advancement of the nation, so that the monarchy therefore could be stronger if the nation now was more successful. So mm-hmm. that model was implemented, and I end up calling it the Prussian approach to higher education, which then was no longer thinking more broadly about purposes serving of service, advancing humanity, but was very mm-hmm. much about advancing the national interest defined by the monarchy. And because all of Europe was in the same state, that was quickly adopted throughout Europe. And because this was also then the age of European imperialism, it was exported all around the world at that mm-hmm. time. So that model became the de facto international model for what higher education should look like and what purpose it was to serve.
One of the interesting documents that you bring forth, and this is not one that I had ever read myself, is the Yale Report of 1828. And you present it as a kind of American response to the German university. Is this a document that the land-grant universities and denominational colleges and other sites of liberal arts knew about in 1828 and the immediate years? Or were its ideals coming to those places mainly by other avenues?
The answer is yes, yes, both. But by and large, what was going on? I mean, the faculty at Yale in the late 1820s were saying, you know, we are still doing the Oxford, Cambridge liberal arts kind of education. Mm-hmm. But that's not what they're doing in Europe. And Europe has everybody agrees Europe has the most advanced higher education system in the world. So should we do that as well? And they ended up rejecting that. In fact, said it would be ludicrous to do so, because the need in the United States, a young United States at that time, was very different. What they said is, we need every person to have this kind of educational experience, because it advances society. It's what our nation mm-hmm. as a democracy needs. We need every person, the farmer and the tinker, as well as those who are well situated, to have this kind of educational approach. So they rejected that, and they then became a first role model of a rejection of the European, the Prussian approach, and the endorsement of this, what they described in the Yale report as actually familial, like family-like approach to mm-hmm. education, with the liberal arts values of breadth of study and so forth. And this corresponded in time to a wildfire of creation, especially of denominational colleges in the mm-hmm. United States. And what they were doing were then emulating what they were seeing happening on the East Coast, where this was the flame that was lit. So they didn't need to read a document to know what to do. But those better educated people, more highly educated people who might be their faculty, came from those institutions, and they knew that model. Mm-hmm. And within a few decades, there were literally more colleges in Ohio than there were in all of England based on this right. ideal. And, you know, every little town wanted to have its own college, because that was a way for itself to have greater stature and make a greater contribution to this developing mm-hmm. nation. So, many, literally hundreds, ultimately more than 1,000 denominational colleges were built based on this emulation of what they saw as the American approach to higher education.
So I can't remember whether your book mentions, or how often it mentions, Charles Eliot of Harvard, but, you know, I'm curious to hear your take on him. I mean, is he trying to keep that liberal arts ideal while still getting towards something more like specialization, or is he more of a person who brings the German model more fully to American colleges, in your view?
And I think it's hard to know how to answer the question. And ultimately, the answer is based on what actually happens. So mm-hmm. so the research approach is not antithetical to a liberal arts approach. they can both happen. So are students still encouraged or in fact required to study outside of their own individual discipline? Well, so that liberal arts values can still be supported. Does teaching actually matter? You can go to a research university in which engagement with students doesn't count. In fact, I know a research university faculty who the way they are rewarded is by not needing to teach. And that reward comes from their publications and research grants they get. And that's the way those places run. And teaching to the degree it happens is handed off to graduate students or part-time faculty or those kinds. So the question is, how does that university ultimately evolve? Does it continue to have students study outside of their discipline? Does it continue to have faculty who are engaged in student learning and not merely in their own research? That really is the question. Getting from here to there and being for a university to be financially viable today is difficult, and it's required institutions to adopt a variety of tactics, research funding, adding specialized majors where they think there is student interest, or a subject like nursing, which can be offered in a liberal arts fashion or not, but where there is great need and demand, et cetera. So I think we are in a time of evolution, and we don't really know quite yet how it's going to work out.
Okay. Well, I want to turn our focus to the survey study that your group undertook of the long-term impacts of liberal arts learning. What was your methodology in this study, and what kinds of questions did your study pose that other defenders and detractors of the liberal arts were not yet posing?
So two parts to that, response to that question. One is these were interviews of 1,000 individuals, and these were individuals from the full range of types of colleges and universities, big, little, research universities, liberal arts colleges, church-related, not church-related, private, public, et cetera. So all kinds. Mm-hmm. They were interview questions. They were asking, and I'll get back to what the interview questions were about. And they were the people who were interviewed were a broad range of ages. So this was not just a what happens to a person when they graduate. These were people ranging in age from about 25 to 65. So the question was about long-term impact, not just short-term impact. So what were the kinds of questions that were asked? First is that there were questions about that person's adult life, whatever their age was. And so it included the most common kinds of questions asked today. How much money do you earn? Yep. What is your job? So it asked those questions, but it also asked about a broad range of other kinds of adult activities, including questions about leadership. Are you involved? Are you a leader in a community or some other kind of organization in your area? Do people come to you for advice about issues which are not in your area of expertise or not part of your job? So leadership it asked about altruistic behavior, like how often do you vote? Do you vote in presidential elections only? Do you vote in non-presidential elections? Do you volunteer? How many hours do you volunteer? Do you contribute money to nonprofits? So altruistic behavior. It asked about the degree to which they are still involved in learning activities, which included, yes, graduate programs or certifications, but it also asked how much time do they spend, reading the newspaper or news materials? How often do they engage in discussions with other people about topics of substance? It asked about cultural involvement. How often do they go to museums or musical performance, or how often do they read about those kinds of things? It also asked about fulfillment? Are they living a life of meaning and fulfillment? How often do they think about the purpose of their life and how it is their what their life is about? So there were then six areas of query mm-hmm. about adult life, and these were all indicators, as I described them, of leadership, altruistic or civic engagement, continued learning, living a life of fulfillment, and a life of success, that is job, money, and income, and so forth. So interview mm-hmm. questions about those things. There were also a set of interview questions about the nature of their educational experience. So mm-hmm. When you went to college, think back to when you went to college, what was your major, which we could then classify as a professional job, a professional major like accounting or a business or non-professionally oriented. It could have been biology or sociology. What was the questions about the span of their study? So what percentage of courses did you take outside your major? Did you take courses in philosophy, et cetera? Were issues of significance to humanity included in course material in your courses outside of the humanities, so in your major courses? Ask questions about intellectual skill development. How, did you have to write papers? Did mm-hmm. professors give you feedback on your thinking and thinking development, et cetera? So development of intellectual skills, that's one. It's three. Vocational major or not, span of study and development of intellectual skills. Then there were three questions about the educational context. How did educational happen? What kind of pedagogy? So what kind of teaching methods were used? Was there discussion in class? Did you get individual feedback, et cetera? So engaging pedagogy. Development of larger perspectives. To what degree did you learn about things that were outside of your prior area of knowledge or interest? Did you spend time talking to students outside of class who were of different religion or nationality or background? Did you? And finally, the sixth one, asked questions about what I called authentic community. So did the professor know you by your first name? Did you talk to professors outside of class time about academic matters, about non-academic matters? Were you involved in campus activities? So all having to do with the nature of that educational community, and I called that authentic community. So what kinds of relationships did they have both with faculty, with staff, and other students? So there was then this boatload of questions, yeah. and I never asked them what mattered in your college education. I then statistically looked for relationships between those life outcomes, leadership, success, civic involvement, and so forth, and these various list of college experiences, and looked for the relationship among them. I categorized them into categories in doing this analysis. And so what was different about this research is really twofold. One is its inclusion of people from all kinds of graduates of all kinds of colleges and universities of all ages. And second, asking for the nature of their experience and the life they are living, and then statistically looking for relationships between. So it was not asking attitudes or opinions. It was then trying to objectively test relationships among all of those things.
Okay. So without giving away too much of the book, because again, I want our listeners to go out and get your book and read it. But I mean, the relationships between, you divide things up into context and content. Were these marginal relationships? Were they, stark and obvious relationships? Were they relationships so powerful that it surprised even you? I mean, in broad terms, again, don't give away too much. We want them to read your book. What sorts of things give us a taste of what these surveys found?
So I have to say I entered this research with trepidation because I had spent my life in higher education, in liberal arts education, in fact. And I knew I had many stories to tell about individuals who told me this or told me that, and you know that it mattered that they came to my college, and I was able to talk about those things. But I had foundation funding for supporting this research, and I knew that whatever I found or did not find couldn't be hidden under a stone. It needed to become public. So I entered it with trepidation. Not knowing what I might find. So that was my starting place. What surprised me most, first is the absolute power of the educational context. That is the nature of the relationships with faculty, with other students matter tremendously. And they matter, might be obvious if you were thinking, well, that would make a person more civically involved, because if they've involved with people on campus, then they're going to continue to be involved. But hey, guess what? Those people who were more successful when you get in the maturity of their career, those were people who had, two most powerful experiences. One is they had many more meaningful relationships with professors when they were undergraduates, professors who knew them by their first name, professors or mentors at the college with whom they could talk outside of class time, not only about academic materials, but about other things as well and so forth. That was one major predictor of people who had a higher income and more significant positions in their organizations. They were presidents or owners or in major positions in organizations. The other major experience they had in their undergraduate experiences is that they took more than half of their coursework outside of their area of specialization, outside of their major. I would not have predicted either one of those outcomes, but they turned out to be very powerful and have impact not only on success, but on continued learning and living a fulfilled life and being culturally involved and so forth. So it was a long list of those kinds of relationships, all of which all of these were statistical analyses, all of them well beyond chance, most of them in a statistical term, less than 1 in 1,000 probability of happening by chance. All of them increasing. So none of these were, if you have this experience, then this is the life outcome. They were not those, but they increased the probability that a person would have that life outcome.
Right.
Did it make a perfect guarantee? No. But when I think about it, gee, if this college experience makes it 25% more likely you will be successful, or 30% more likely you'll live a fulfilled life, boy, that's a bet worth placing. So those are the kinds of relationships that occurred between this, the content and the context of education, with context carrying more weight than the content of study on long-term life outcomes. And I could talk to you about all of them, but I won't do that because we don't have that time. And as you say, they're all in the book and you can find them there.
Yes, yes. We want our listeners to read your book.
That's it.
Now, your discussions of success really interested me, both because you grant that success as a concept has always been a disputed matter. And also, I mean, you seem to discover in your research that the success benefits of liberal arts don't come out evenly in every group of educated people. So say a little bit about both of those. I mean, what kinds of indicators of success counted in this study? How broad, was the span of definitions of success? And then what groups of people seem to benefit most in terms of that success from liberal arts education?
So there were basically two categories of question that related to success. One was literally income. What is your income? And the second had to do with the nature of a position a person was in, if they were working. And so that had to do with, are you the head of, the president of, the owner of, are you, meaningful, influential position in an organization or not. So it was those two categories. When we did analyses of who benefited most, the effects were consistent across race, gender, and the person's educational quality, so SAT scores in when they applied to college and high school grades and those kinds of things. However, these effects were 2 to 3 times more powerful for people who came from a lower SES family background. So huge power, as I say, 2 to 3 times as powerful for people from a lower SES background than for those who came from middle or upper class family background.
And that's so an that important thing, because, I mean, one of the stereotypes about university education more broadly, but especially, you know, the very selective, you know, Stanfords and Harvards and Dukes and so on and so forth, is that they are simply, you know, finishing schools. They are networking centers for the children of the wealthy to, you know, marry other children of other wealthy. And of course, they all turn out successful because they all from success. That's not what your study turned up.
That's right. Yeah. And certainly success breeds the success as you describe, but that's not what actually happens in higher education. The impact is far greater for those people who come out of without those advantages when they enter college. Pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things you said is that context and content both matter. Context, though, just punches harder. So yeah. I want to hear you talk a little bit more about learning in community. What is beneficial and what is detrimental about the impulse that many colleges have, especially in narrowly professional majors like medical majors, business majors, things of that sort, to increase the hours that students spend away from the campus? A lot of colleges boast that, you know, we have more field experience hours, we have more internships than anyone else. Is that a counterproductive thing, or is it a piece of the puzzle that I'm just not seeing the fit for?
It can be positive or negative. If it is merely something that students are sent out to do without the proper context around it, I'm using context more broadly now. Then it's likely to be a net loss to the student. If they are used to give students meaningful experience both with both in some applied kind of setting, some practical setting, but also with people who are there. So do you have a mentor in that experience who is with whom you have a relationship, who is caring about what you're learning, what you're thinking, what your experience is, who can talk to you about what's going on in this experience and with your life more broadly, who can help tailor that experience to be meaningful to the person. So is a person just filing papers because they need somebody cheap or free to file paperwork? Then that's absolutely a net loss. But if it's set up in a way that those kinds of experiences happen, then that is a net gain. It also needs to be connected back to the campus. So who is it on the campus that is responsible for that student's off-campus placement and experience? Are they also now engaged with that student in asking them questions and having them reflect on and talk about the implications of their experiences and what they're learning for their, what they're thinking about their life and their career and what matters to them in their life? So it can be used as a powerful positive, but it requires that to be done in a very intentional way and not just in a way that gets the only goal is to get students off campus or to be able to claim in the PR or admissions materials that they do a lot of that. So positive
or negative. Right. And I mean, this ties in with, you know, one of my own peeves, both, you know, at the college level and, you know, in high schools where I now teach, you know, the fascination with, you know, so-called real world experience. And I, you know, the question I always pose is, well, I mean, when can I visit this real world? It sounds fascinating, but, you know, what strikes me here is that, the relationship angle really does matter. And again, what is, it was taking me by surprise a little bit, is that the educational community doesn't have to be confined to the campus. It is the strength of the relationships rather than the location of the relationships that matters more. Is it, am I getting you basically right there?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Very good. here at the end, we've not touched on all the interesting things that this book gets into, listeners, so be sure you do get your hands on a copy of this book. But I do want to get into the question of cost for a moment. When I was a professor at a small Christian college, my students often complained that their counterparts at Kennesaw State University, and it was always Kennesaw State for some reason, spent far less money than they did, and Kennesaw's cafeteria food was better than Emmanuel's. So setting aside the question of food service for a moment, talk a little bit about the real cost of college, because this is something that the book treats in some pretty interesting ways. How does the real cost of a liberal arts education compare to the real cost per student to educate students in a more research-focused setting?
Cost is one of the cost of higher education is one of the most profoundly confused issues in American higher education. And we in higher education bear a substantial part of the blame for that, I have to say. So we have the price people oftentimes now will distinguish between sticker price. So what does it cost to go to that college? And people say, oh, it's going to cost $50,000 or $70,000. That's the price that is on the sticker. But that's not actually what most people pay, because we have created financial support for students, financial support based on financial need, and financial support based on merit, with merit broadly defined in all different kinds of ways by different institutions. So at that college with a $50,000 tuition price, you know, it's likely that the average student, the typical student there, is actually only needing to pay $20,000. That would be a very common kind of outcome. Now, complicating all of this is people then also throw into the same bucket. It's going to cost me $70,000 a year to go to college. Well, they're also adding in room and board costs, tuition costs. Room and board by itself, likely, I mean, and is $15,000 to $20,000.
Right.
And that's not unlikely. If I were to say I can move to this town, and I can have a roof over my head and food to eat, and a recreation center to go to for $15,000 to $20,000 a year. I mean, that would be great. Who could, you know, live well for $15,000 to $20,000 a year? That's what colleges are providing for room and board. But that's different from the educational cost. Student can stay live at home and go to their local college and not need to have that cost. Over recent years, over the last 30 years, what used to be federal and state aid in grants has been changed to be federal and state aid in loans substantially.
Yes.
And so, in fact, our society at the same time has been supporting students in their higher education experience much less than they used to, because they've changed from grants to loans. And what I say to the reality is, you can provide a liberal arts education no more expensively than most any other kind. Even I have to say, even K-12 education. You know, I think the average K-12 educational cost at this point in time is about nationally in the U.S. is about $18,000. Well, if it costs $18,000 to get a K-12 education, and I could go to a college which has far more expensive facilities for me if I want them, and small classes for $20,000 a year, that sounds like a pretty good buy. So, and to provide just that liberal arts experience, you can provide that no more expensively, in fact, less expensively than what a research university can do. So I think the important thing for people to recognize is, if you look specifically at the nature of the educational experience students are having, and ask what that costs, that can be provided for that same $20,000 a year that is spent in other kinds of educational contexts.
Very good. I want to ask you a question that weren't in the notes. So listeners, please understand I am ambushing Rick with this one. And I'll go ahead and preface this by saying I know the answer is everybody, but I want you to imagine for me some concrete initiatives that people could take to make this case for the liberal arts to those people who are looking at education? I mean, what quarters do you imagine this appeal coming from? Who is it that's making the appeal? What media would be especially good for doing it? I want my friends who are still in the college world to have not just some hope, because I think you've given some of that, but also some ideas. So where should this appeal be happening in the next 10 years, in the next 5 years, whatever span you imagine?
Yeah, I think the appeals at this, the most critical appeals at this point, and I have to say that I have yet to find the right avenue for access in either places. So if any of your listeners have good ideas, please let me know. I would love that. One is parents. Now, parents are meaningful in many, though not all students. For at least traditional age students, parents are extremely meaningful. So having parents be educated about what is really going to matter, if they care about the outcomes their child is going to have as a result of their life experience in college, then focus on some of these, the nature of the educational experience, the context of education, move off of the focus on specialization and encourage their son or daughter to go a place where they're able to have a broader education. So that's certainly one. A second is high school teachers and high school guidance counselors who can also, they are all the time talking with students about that think they may want to go to college. To be focusing them on understanding what really is it that matters in college, not to sell the prestige. Prestige, has some shorter term impact on income, but longer term, not much. What a student gets from the nature of the experience is what really has an impact. So I would turn my thinking and focus on those kinds of endeavors. Those who are currently on campuses, take any opportunity you have to give a talk at the high school or to talk to teachers at a high school, or look at those as meaningful relationships to develop. When there are campus visitation days, go spend time with prospective students and parents and engage them in thinking not just about the flashy, shiny parts of your institution, but in thinking about what is it that'll make an education, create an education that will make a difference in that person's life in ways that matter to them. Not matter to them, because they will live a more fulfilled and successful and meaningful life. It's not the institution's goal. It's their goal. And that's where the impact of context, the whole educational environment, the ecology of education, as I describe it in the book, really does matter.
Very good. Well, Rick, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about liberal arts, American colleges, or anything else as we head for the door?
I would link it really to my last answer, and that is to say, focus on life outcomes, not on courses to be taken, but on life outcomes. What outcomes do you, and ideally your university, your college, seek to create? Are you in, are you wanting, are you going to feel fulfilled as an educator because your student makes a lot of money, because your student becomes a leader, because your student lives a fulfilled life, because your student is civically involved? So think about those life outcomes and work back from those life outcomes that you value most to the kinds of experiences you need your students to have. And the book then gives you lots of kinds of experiences that the students would have, many of them so focused, so dependent on the faculty's relationship with students, not only inside, but also outside the classroom, and developing meaningful relationships with your students. And if you care about meaningful life outcomes, That's the way to really have an impact on the lives of students who will graduate based on your mentoring.
Weiler, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
I'm delighted to be with you, Nathan. Thank you for the time.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is The Evidence Liberal Arts Needs from MIT Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.